New Perspectives Open Pitch presents Memoirs of a Little 'Un, a 10-part collection of heartwarming stories and reminiscences of growing up in rural England during the 60s by Chrissy Payne. Part 1, Sunday's Child.
Bonjo, the big grey tomcat, carefully glides through the parade of dustbins and with great precision avoids the empty milk bottles that grace every doorstep. Just what makes a cat leave the comfort of the hearthrug, where his outstretched legs and paws are almost in the fire grate? Could it be curiosity? Bonjo checks the length of the street, but there's nothing doing. It has been sleeting on and off all day, and the wet snow settles on Bonjo's thick coat. The street glistens shiny and black in the night time, the flurries of sleet constant under the glare of the street lights. The houses of the little market town are like fortresses against the bleak February weather. Heavy curtains are drawn tight in the bay windows, and colourful sausage dog draught excluders plug the gap between the bottom of the front door and the cold world outside. Occupants become overheated in their little rooms, although it would be a different story when it was time to turn in. No blazing fire upstairs, just flannelette bedding and a hot water bottle. Sunday night, February 1959, the final bit of rest and relaxation before the start of the new working week. Bonjo shakes himself, has a quick pee against the dented side of next door's dustbin, and then squeezes his damp body through the cat flap and takes up his spot once again on the hearthrug in front of the fire. The occupants don't chastise him for his mucky paws. They are transfixed by the new TV show, Rawhide, and the little room is filled with cacti and galloping piebald horses. Not everyone has succumbed to the delights of the television. On the other side of the level crossing shines a beery light, a lone welcoming lamp in a sea of shuttered shops. The imposing building has an exterior wall of flaking paint, and on an advertisement the words Bass Beers stand out in letters 5 feet tall. Sleet splatters the old pub sign, as it has for 2 centuries or more, but the white lion stands proud and firm against the elements. Never that busy on a Sunday night, a few regulars prop up the bar. If this was an altar, then Dorry, the landlady, would be the high priestess. She is surrounded by gleaming mirror glass, brass that glows in the firelight, and in place of candles, neatly stacked jars of cockles and syrupy glacé cherries. The men look into their beers and grasp at the comforting dimpled glass of their beer mugs. An occasional comment is made, and the assembled group respond in turn, sparingly, in a short monosyllable code. Dorry now rearranges the bottles of fruit juice and wishes she was upstairs soaking her feet in a bowl in front of the television, drooling over the cowboys in check shirts and not a flat cap between them. Suddenly, the door swings open and a great blast of cold air swirls around the bar. Sid enters, swathed in a greatcoat, muffler and gauntlet gloves. He stamps his boots in the doorwell. The sleet that covers him from head to foot as he walks in doesn't stand a chance in the pub where the fire never goes out, and it vanishes in a trice.
"Brass monkeys out there," says Sid,
patting his arms with his impressive gauntlet gloves.
"Line 'em up, Dorry, and take one for yourself.
Oh, thanks, Sid. Mind if I have a rum and black? Keep the chill out.
Any news, Sid?
The small group at the bar are momentarily distracted from their beers.
Yes, just taken a call.
Sid takes on the demeanour of a newscaster, trying to remain impassive whilst revealing a world exclusive.
And?
The group inquires in unison.
Another girl. They've had another girl.
A groan goes up from the little gathering. That is, with the exception of Dorry.
Poor Sam. A house full of women. What are the chances of having seven daughters?
Says one. What when they all marry? Seven weddings to pay for. Poor bugger will be bankrupt, says another.
Now, who was that chap out at Withcote? Had 11 kids? Or was it 12?
Not surprised. Bugger all to do out there. No pub. I suppose Braunston would be the closest pint for him.
No, I reckon Nossington is closer. What do you think, Sid?
Dorry is bewildered and continually amazed at how her regulars take such delight in such banal conversations. She rearranges the fruit juices once again and fantasises of saloon bars, pouring neat bourbon, and the cowboys in check shirts. The purpose-built maternity wing has been a great achievement for the county. Cutting edge and with all the latest equipment, the extension resembles a child's attempt at construction with a box of wooden building blocks. It screams modernity and is totally at odds with the solid building it is latched onto, built from public subscription at a time of cloche hats and diphtheria. Popular star of stage and screen, Miss Lena Webb, did the honours and had officially opened the new wing just a few weeks earlier.
Is that a scarf on the fresh paintwork?
Matron patrols the new wing, peering over the top of her glasses. She couldn't have taken a greater interest if the building contractors had extended her own modest dwelling on Station Road. But in a way, they have. To all intent and purposes, they created for Matron a new living room. This was her home, her life, and she could rearrange the furniture to her heart's content. Matron is momentarily distracted from the scuff on the paintwork. Her nostrils twitch. What is that odour? She quickens the pace of her twitching and, like a seasoned bloodhound, goes to the source of the smell.
Chrysanthemums!
Matron peers at the water in the crystal vase, which has turned a murky shade of brown. Matron disliked chrysanthemums at the best of times, and as she scrutinised further, detected the beginnings of a slimy substance on the stalks.
Nurse Thompson, come here immediately.
It sounds urgent. Can't be an outbreak of smallpox, thinks Nurse Thompson. That's been eradicated. She rushes into the foyer of the new wing. Matron looms large, overpowering the framed photograph of Miss Lena Webb, wearing tweed and fox fur, accompanied by the town bigwigs, weighted down by chains of office and other assorted pieces of metalwork. Arm extended and head facing the opposite direction in total disgust, Matron lunges at the offending floral tribute and gestures to Nurse Thompson.
Dispose of this at once. Freesias, I think, because unless we can have something befitting next to our photograph of Miss Morris, I would rather have no floral tribute at all. I will certainly not countenance flowers that look as if they've come off an allotment in my wing.
Nurse Thompson knew better than to answer back. If Matron hadn't been so handy with the kidney bowl and sutures, she could have certainly tried out for the Old Vic and given Dame Edith Evans a run for her money. And Mrs. Fox, how are her movements? Any progress?
Yes, Matron. She's had a wander around the ward and has taken the latest Howard Spring off the book trolley.
You stupid girl. I'm talking about her bowels. How are Mrs. Fox's bowel movements?
The outer door swings open, and the sleet of the previous night has given way to a weak and watery winter sun that has spent all its energy to be something, only to be chased away by a moon that hovers in readiness on these short winter days.
And who are you? Stay on the doormat, please, whilst you reply.
I'm Miss Sandra Hoy, and I'm here to visit my mum. She had a baby last night.
This was turning out to be an eventful afternoon for Matron. You can't come in here. You are a child. Strictly not allowed.
Unlike Nurse Thompson, Sandra isn't having any of it.
I am nearly 15, and in some countries I could be married by now.
Matron peers over the top of her glasses.
Thankfully not in this one, she replies.
Sandra, however, isn't backing down.
That's ridiculous. A complete contradiction in terms. How can you ban children when you're full of babies? They're children too, aren't they? I think you will find that you are contravening the Javina Convention or something like that, and I shall be writing to my MP and, of course, Miss Lena Webb.
Nurse Thompson thought she'd burst with excitement. You wait when they hear about this in the nurses' home tonight, she thought.
Before Matron can draw breath, Sandra continues. She knows she has Matron in a corner, and years of squabbling and bossing her younger sisters about has prepared her beautifully for a moment such as this. She changes the tone of her voice and adopts an air of superiority. Sandra has seen this done before in films and fancies herself as a Bette Davis.
I have brought some jam tarts for my mother's tea-time treat. Pray, tell me, have you also banned tarts from this establishment? They have been freshly baked in my cookery class this very afternoon, and my teacher, Miss Woodcock, of whom I'm sure you are acquainted, has graciously allowed me to use a plate from school for this very purpose.
Then, changing her tone slightly again, inquires, perhaps you or your colleague here would care to partake of one?
Extraordinary. Matron is rendered speechless, but soon regains her composure.
Perhaps we can reach a compromise. I shall open the window to your mother's room, and you can converse with her. For only 5 minutes, mind you, and no longer. You will, of course, have to remain outside.
Thank you, Matron. I'm so relieved we've come to a satisfactory conclusion, as I do hate conflict of any kind.
Sandra clutches the big old toffee tin, decorated with a lovely skating couple in Regency dress, close to her chest. It has seen better days, but is the perfect size for her culinary exploits. She passes a little sapling that shivers in the weak sunlight. A plaque positioned at the base of its feeble trunk states it has been planted by Lena and the local bigwigs. She sees a window slightly ajar and rightly assumes it is Mother's room. Peers through where both mother and baby are sleeping. Mother looks tired and quite pale, and the emergence of fine grey hairs around her temples signal to the world that she is no spring chicken. And Sandra, confronted by the scene, is taken aback. My dear old mum, she thinks, and a tear rolls down her cheek uncontrollably.
Psst! Mum, it's me.
Mother opens her eyes and is startled to see Sandra. The old dragon won't let me in, and I've brought you my jam tarts for tea. Miss Woodcock says they're a triumph, very evenly baked, although you should have seen poor Angela Milner's jam all over the shop. She's had to leave the patty tin in soak overnight, and Miss Woodcock reckons if it can't be cleaned, Angela will have to replace it out of her own pocket. The old dragon enters the room.
Are you terribly disappointed, Mum?
And with all the innocence of a teenager of the 1950s, adds,
you could always try again, in a couple of years, perhaps.
A knowing glance passes between Mum and the matron. I don't think so, Sandy. This little un is the last. And so it was. One chill afternoon, I left the starched sheets and carbolic soap and was placed in the old brown wooden cot positioned in an alcove in my parents' bedroom. All my sisters had been in the cot, and numerous others, no doubt, as it would certainly have been a sale room purchase by father.
Look at the craftsmanship. They don't make furniture like this anymore.
I can well imagine father giving it the hard sell to my poor, bewildered mother. But I was happy in the old brown cot, where a sea of different faces would peer in at me, and in the fullness of time provide me with non-stop entertainment and treasured memories of life in the old house on the corner of the street. The end.
Sunday's Child by Chrissy Payne was performed by Juanita McMahon, with sound design by Adam P. McCready, supported using public funding from Arts Council England. It's produced by New Perspectives Theatre Company's Open Pitch, a unique community programme that showcases extraordinary stories from across the East Midlands.